guess the reason that psychotherapy takes time, and that's not a very popular message in today's sort of fast-paced, quick cure culture, you know. And it's certainly not a very popular message for government bodies who fund mental health. They would like us to be able to, you know, deliver a quick cure. But to really get to the bedrock, I guess, of the issues that people struggle with takes time, because you have to get to know them very well, and you've also got to develop a very strong relationship with them in order to be able to, as Jill said earlier, be the person bearing the bad news in a way of, you know, much though you want me to validate you around how awful your husband has been, and I'm doing that, I also want you to see what you might be bringing to the party, so to speak. And, you know, the person has to have a pretty good relationship with you before they are happy to hear that message. But to go to, you know, the issue of childhood, certainly I don't think we can get away from the fact that our childhood indelibly influences the way we develop, how we feel about ourselves, and how we feel about other people and our capacity to be close to them or distant. But the point we make in the book is that this is not the only thing that influences us. You know, there's a lot of debate around nature and nurture, and of course, you know, nature plays a big role, what we're born with, in a way, the temperament we're born with. But also, Jill made a reference earlier to the zeitgeist. So the socio-historical and cultural era that you're born into also interacts with nature and nurture in a particular way, so that the kinds of issues that we might encounter now perhaps would be different to what they were in Freud's time. You know, if you just take the example of the hysteric that, you know. The fourth thing that we emphasize in the book is that as humans, we also have agency and choice, and particularly as adult humans, but even as children, there's a level of agency and choice. And so there's not a sort of linear trajectory from one childhood experience to one particular issue in adulthood. It's always anecdotal and complex.
But Steve, in addition to everything that Jax is saying, and she's taking the big picture, which I totally agree with her on what she's saying, but I think you were also asking both and a question about how would this play out in relation to somebody like Charlene. And just to confirm what Jackie is saying is that we're very clear that therapy is a sacred trust, so we're not talking about people that we've treated specifically. It's about all of our patients, all of our family, all of our friends, and ourselves are actually in those case stories, as we call them. But going back to how it might play out for somebody like Charlene, for example, everything that I might say, which is actually neutral, she will hear as critical and respond as if it's critical. And eventually, when you've got trust and you've been working with this and observing this for a long time, you might invite her to take a meta position on how the experience is always criticism and what really drives that, and to suggest perhaps that it's self-criticism that is being projected, and why is there this self-criticism. And so you start from the present and then drill backwards back into the past, not jump into the past and then try to move to the present. So it would play itself out. Perhaps that would be one way in which it could play itself out. But I think you're also pointing to the fact that when shame is involved, as was the case with Charlene, it's really difficult, because to talk about shame evokes shame. So there's how do you kind of be aware of that and work with that?
Another aspect of the unconscious you talk about is the sort of nature of attraction, and how like traumatic childhood can in situations condition an individual to sort of hardwire a sort of attraction toward particular sorts of sort of dominant men or women. Now, we all probably do this. I mean, we all have, when, particularly when we're young, we want parental approval of who we desire. But how do you go about getting people to recognize that they're maybe being drawn to the wrong people?
Well, that's a good one, Stephen. In my experience, unfortunately, they've had really bad experiences usually by the time they come. They've been in a couple of relationships with controlling or even abusive people. So they come in the knowledge that they are being attracted to the wrong person. But it goes to your point about the irrationality or the seeming irrationality, because, as you say, in our childhood, we do want people who we can idealize. Mm. And I think there's several reasons why we might go for controlling individuals, certainly if we're in the wild. So to go to the ethological view, the alpha male is the one that everybody would be looking to, and he would be conferring protection. So there's some natural attraction. Also, we start off, as you point out, with a powerful other, as in the mother or the father. And so we've got a natural predisposition to perhaps think about that. But as we go along, we also get a distinction between reality and fantasy. And if you think about how popular 50 Shades of Grey was, it was outrageously popular. And that will tell you how popular the fantasy is of giving over control to somebody who's going to make all these decisions for you, no responsibility, marvelous. But unfortunately, there's a faulty fantasy that they'll make all the decisions in your favor, which of course doesn't come to pass. But most people stick at the fantasy of reading 50 Shades of Grey and don't go out and actualize it. So there's also something about not having that distinction between reality and fantasy when people start to get attracted to the very controlling other.